From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of Interfaith Alliance. We're broadcasting from Air America headquarters in New York City. And on today's show, a Christian theologian and a former Catholic priest will tell us how he learned to better understand his faith by studying another. Buddhism, he says, made him a better Christian. We'll find out more in our interview coming up. Plus, a look at how the Baha'i community here in the United States is helping raise awareness about fellow Baha'is imprisoned abroad. A leader of this faith community joins me shortly to shed some light on the fate of seven religious prisoners in Iran. But first, we turn our attention to the Supreme Court, where the justices recently heard a potentially monumental First Amendment case, one we've discussed on State of Belief a few months ago. The case is called Salazar versus Buono, and it centers around a large white cross in the Mojave National Preserve. The cross was built in the 1930s by the veterans of foreign wars as a memorial to fallen soldiers. But Frank Buono, an employee of the park, argued that the cross violated the First Amendment. He filed a lawsuit back in 1999, but Congress intervened and transferred the property to the VFW so the cross actually would be sitting on private land. Now the Supreme Court must decide whether the cross can stay or not and whether the land transfer actually was legal. This case has gotten a lot of attention, and I was particularly interested in a line of reasoning put forth by Justice Antonin Scalia during oral arguments last week. Scalia essentially said he didn't believe the cross was a Christian symbol. Rather, he said, the cross is the most common symbol of the resting place of the dead. A secular symbol of death. I'm joined right now by Paul Wallman. Paul is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect magazine, in which he wrote about this case. Paul, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
My pleasure.
This case is obviously about the First Amendment, but you say the case is also really about empathy. Explain that, please.
Well, folks might remember that when President Obama was campaigning for president, and was asked about what he would look for in a potential Supreme Court justice, one of the things that he said was he wanted someone who had empathy, who was able to understand the feelings of people different from themselves and put themselves in other people's shoes. At the time, conservatives complained about that. They thought that that was inappropriate, and their argument was, well, it doesn't matter whether you have empathy. What matters is whether you apply the law strictly. But I thought about that little campaign dust-up when I read what Scalia has said. Because I think what it shows is that it's oftentimes difficult for people who are in a position of power or who are members of the group that's the dominant group, whether it's a racial group or it's men, the dominant gender, or a religious group, to kind of step back and put themselves in somebody else's shoes. And so when Scalia was kind of expressing his disbelief at the argument that the ACLU lawyer was making in this case, that a cross doesn't really represent all war dead, it just represents the Christian ones, Scalia's response was, well, what are you talking about? It's just a symbol of honoring the dead. I think that's indicative of a kind of lack of empathy that for someone who's a Christian, some people may find it hard to imagine, well, if you weren't a Christian, would you look at that cross and feel that it honors the members of your group or honors you in particular?
I actually thought the ACLU lawyer, Peter Eliasberg, who argued the case, had a fairly good response to Scalia's line of reasoning, pointing out that one's hard-pressed to find any crosses in Jewish cemeteries.
Yeah, and that when Scalia was saying that it's just a sort of a universal symbol honoring the dead, that's what he said, that I've been in a lot of Jewish cemeteries and I've never seen the cross on the grave of a Jew. And people in the courtroom laughed. And if you know anything about Antonin Scalia, you could see, you could imagine that the steam was coming out of his ears at that point. Given what happened in the arguments, it looks like they're probably going to let this memorial stand. That would be my guess anyway, although you never know. You know, and it's oftentimes hard to predict. You know, back in 2005, the Supreme Court heard two cases about posting of the Ten Commandments, one from Kentucky and one from Texas. And they came to opposite rulings. They said that the Texas posting of the Ten Commandments was okay and passed constitutional muster. And they said that the Kentucky posting of the Ten Commandments was not okay. And what it came down to was that the one in Texas had just been around for a long time and no one had really paid it much attention, and the one in Kentucky was the state officials obviously trying to get that into as many government buildings as possible to sort of impose their religious views. So they often get into what can kind of seem like hair-splitting about what the intentions of the people were and things like that to decide whether a religious presentation on government property is allowed or not.
I think often that these cases about religious symbols on public land are dismissed by their opponents as people like me nitpicking about the First Amendment. And I think the problem is they, like Scalia, can't imagine who these displays are adversely affecting. It's kind of a where's the victim mentality, isn't it?
Right. And that's why you see that these kinds of cases are usually brought by people from a few different groups. Either they're Jewish people or sometimes people like Jehovah's Witnesses who have brought some of the key cases about the Establishment Clause, or sometimes it's atheists. It's almost never somebody who's sort of a mainline Christian who feels like they're in the majority. One of the things that I said in that column was if you could try to imagine, if you were somebody who thinks that prayer in schools is just fine, imagine you went to, say, Dearborn, Michigan, which has largest concentration of Muslims of any city in America, and let's say that the local public school said, where you were sending your children, said, well, we think prayer in schools is just fine, so we want to start every day with a reading from the Quran. Well, you'd probably suddenly feel like, wait a second, that's not okay, and it's because you find yourself in the minority. Things look very different when you're in the majority, and your culture is just the culture. Your religion is the one that everyone accepts. But the fact of the matter is that America is growing more diverse every single day. And that diversity, I think, is going to make everybody, not just people who are members of minority groups, but even Christians who still form a healthy majority of the country, they're going to have to confront those questions, and hopefully it will become easier for all of us to put ourselves in each other's shoes. We can hope.
Paul Waldman is senior correspondent for the American Prospect. Paul, thanks for talking with us on State of Belief.
It's been my pleasure.
If you want to hear more of my conversation with Paul Waldman, including his prediction on the outcome of the case, go to stateofbelief.com. You'll find it there. We've got to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, I have some comments to share with you on the rising tide of incivility in our midst. Short break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Thomas Jefferson once warned that an enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. In full agreement with this respected founder of our nation, I want to dare risk an addendum to Mr. Jefferson's comment Civility, too, is a necessity for assuring a vital democracy, a healthy republic, and a nation not crippled by unnecessary divisions. From all appearances, however, incivility has once again reached crisis proportions among us. The situation is growing more and more dangerous, threatening the kind of public debate essential in lawmaking, dumping vitriolic dispersions on national leaders in an effort to stir a distrust of them, and perpetrating public divisions that elevate partisanship and ideology over providing for the public welfare, thus crippling our government's ability to make essential decisions. The list of anecdotal evidence of efforts to whip incivility into a cyclonic blast across our nation is too long to even begin to detail in a brief commentary. I'm confident that you're familiar with some of the worst components of this storm. Talk show host Glenn Beck has pointed to President Obama and said that citizens should react to the president's policies as did those responding to the collapse of freedom and offense to humanity in Nazi Germany. I'm sad to say that incivility resounds not just through the airwaves of talk show hosts grabbing for headlines, but also within the halls of Congress and the headquarters of our major political parties. Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson from Florida referred to the failure to reform the U.S. healthcare system as a holocaust. The Republican National Committee doctored a video parody to convey the impression that Hitler criticized the Democrats' healthcare proposals. A prominent leader in the Southern Baptist Convention picked up such sick logic and, with a clerical voice, likened some current proposals for health care reform to, his words, what the Nazis did. Now, to be sure, in most instances, apologies followed, too late, too weak, and inept at correcting the poisoning that had been vomited into the air of the republic. What in the world is wrong with us, friends? I'm happy to report that several colleagues from various religious communities across the nation joined me this past week in issuing a statement decrying such incivility and pleading for a restoration of conversations and actions that strengthen rather than weaken our government. But of course, even this action was greeted by some who considered it grandstanding or politicking. Friends, to associate appropriately vigorous debate on an important legislative initiative with the Holocaust or Nazism is not only to do a disservice to history and to act uncivilly, it's to offend Jews in our midst whose legacy includes the murders of members of their families and subtly, ever so subtly, to cast dispersions on Jewish leadership in the current debate. There is no proper analogy here. None. No current debate or policy can be compared to one of the darkest periods of history in our world. The Nazi language must stop. Depictions of the president as Hitler provide far more insight into the character of the speakers than the one attacked. Come on, people. Perhaps one word of reminder is in order. Civility is not a milquetoast value. My call is not for superficial debate with passive spirits and feigned words of kindness. Civility is a manner of speaking about the toughest issues possible, but doing so in a way in which speakers hear each other, learn from each other, embrace political compromise to find common ground, and to form public policy that meets the constitutional requirement of providing for the public welfare by means that once the debate falls silent and new law takes place, the nation is not the worse for the process, but is better off, and its citizens, all of its citizens, better served. Either we will wake up and reassert our commitment to civility, or we will be up, unrestful and sleepless because of a long nightmare in which we see democracy jeopardized and the people of our nation even more deeply divided. Anyone who wants that condition and conscientiously contributes to it should question not only their national patriotism, but their personal sanity. I'm Welton Gaddy, and we've got to take another quick break. But before we do, I want to share with you some of the great mail that we've been getting recently from listeners. On last week's show, we featured an interview about religion with Karen Armstrong. She talked about our new book, The Case for God. This interview resonated with a lot of you. A listener named Franklin wrote in to say, "Your most recent show was simply excellent. The fundamental question facing humanity shouldn't be whether there's a God. Of course there is. Something or somebody put the universe into motion. It wasn't you and it wasn't me. Whatever you call this eternal entity, that's God. Now, the only issue remaining is whether this entity deserves or requires worship. The answer is clearly no. Why? Because despite your guest beating around the bush on this issue, God isn't something to be worshipped. God is something to be experienced." Now, Franklin goes on to say, "If you go to church or temple or mosque looking for God, you'll be disappointed because we should be bringing God with us to those sacred places. This is the answer to our daily prayers." Franklin, you listened carefully and you have commented wisely. Thank you for taking time to write to us. And thanks to Doug from Boca Raton, who wrote to say, "What a great show with Karen Armstrong, who so well articulated a lot of the thoughts that have been running through my mind for decades." Doug, we really appreciate your input. You voiced something that we've heard from other listeners as well. And finally, Rick from California wrote in response to my recent comments calling for religious leaders to stop inciting conflict and start working to silence the rifles of war. Rick says, "I don't think there will be much movement towards silencing the rifles of war around the world until mankind can accomplish one of two things: either remove all religious influence on all governments of the world when making policy, fat chance of that, or start actually living by the lessons taught in the Bible and other religious manuscripts. I," he said, "don't believe in God per se, but do believe in the lessons offered in the Bible, which seem to be based on tolerance, peace, and forgiveness, concepts that are diametrically opposed to war to begin with." You see why I love to hear from you all? You have such good thoughts to share with us, astute points from all of our listeners who wrote in and talked with us about these recent shows. What's on your mind? Let us know at stateofbelief.com. But don't do that right now. In fact, don't go anywhere just yet, because there's a lot more to come on today's show. Please stay tuned. We will be right back. Welton Gaddy, this is State of Belief. As host of this show and president of Interfaith Alliance, one of my goals is to promote dialogue and understanding among members of different religious traditions. That's why I was so delighted to read about a new book called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. The book's written by Paul Nitter, a professor at Union Theological Seminary. In his book, Professor Nitter describes his lifelong relationship with Christianity. At age 13, he even announced to his parents that he was going to join the priesthood. He later left the clergy, but Paul remains a prominent theologian, and he writes very candidly about the struggles that he's faced with his faith. And look, I'm not talking about struggles with the church. I'm talking about struggles with big questions of faith, questions about the nature of God and the existence of heaven or hell. The resolution to these questions lay, as Paul discovered, for him, not in the teachings of his own faith, but in an entirely different faith, Buddhism. Through what he's dubbed a sort of double belonging, Paul Nitter's study of Buddhism has actually deepened and even changed his understanding of Christianity. Paul Nitter joins me right now in studio so we can talk more about his ideas and his book. Remember, the book is called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. I dare you to read the book and not find it interesting. Paul, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Delighted to be here, Wilton.
You say in the very beginning of the book that it's somewhat a selfish book because you wanted to write this for your own benefit. When did you decide this needs to be shared?
Well, it was about, now let me calculate, about 8 or 9 years ago when I retired from almost 30 years of teaching at Xavier University in Cincinnati, a Catholic, a Jesuit university. And throughout my teaching career and my research and writing, I have been growing in an awareness that really I am looking at my Christian identity and my Christian tradition with Buddhist glasses.
You describe in the book the process of using Buddhist teachings as a way of better understanding Christian doctrine. You call it a sort of passing back and forth or a double belonging. I'm curious how you managed to achieve that without creating either syncretism or a sort of watered-down version of both religions.
Yeah, well, Welton, I could put your question a little bit more pointedly in the language that some of my students use, and they told me all this experimenting with Buddhism and passing over to Buddhism sure looked like religious promiscuity. or as one student put it, it looks like you're sleeping around religiously. Well, I mean, it is not that. At least not in my experience, in the experience of many people who are engaged in what is called double belonging. But generally, the so-called double belongers have a primary commitment. Mm-hmm. I mean, as in a marriage relationship, there is a primary partner from which is exactly that, primary. And that means in a religious context, that's a tradition that gives the primary nurturing, the primary direction. However, double belongers have discovered that they can be, and for some of us, we need to be also nurtured by other relations. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of your primary commitment is to your spouse, but that relationship is nurtured by the friendships and relationships you have with others. So mm-hmm. It's something like this. And for many of us, given the state of Christianity, given some of the problems that people have with Christianity, this kind of nurturing or help from another religious tradition is proving to be very, as I said, not just beneficial, but essential.
Recently on the program, I spoke with Karen Armstrong, the prominent religion writer. Karen often says that at the heart of all religions is the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. She is now working on this issue of compassion, mm-hmm. which she sees as a common value. I think what I read you saying was something a little bit different, and that is that religions still have a lot of differences that we need to be honest about. And if I see your goal correctly, it's not necessarily to find commonalities
exactly.
between the faiths.
Yes, right.
Talk a little about
no,
that.
No, I mean, just from my studies, and I know Karen, and I know she would agree with this as well. But there are differences between the religions, which, in a sense, you just cannot reconcile. I mean, they really just stand as apparently contradictions, and there are such contradictions. Now, I don't want to do away with those, just out of respect for people in other religions, but also because I have discovered many of us double belongers have discovered that it is precisely in those points that look to be contradictions. I give you the Christian belief, there is a God, the Buddhist belief, there is no God. Can't get much more of a contradiction than that. Right. But those kind of apparent contradictions turn out, when you look into what do the Buddhists mean when they say that? Why are they saying that? What do the Christians mean when they say there is a God? Then you suddenly start seeing that what seem to be contradictions are differences that provide opportunities for deeper understanding.
I want to pick up exactly on your reference about God, because you say in the book Buddhism helps you find God, and I know that you had some very fundamental questions about the Christian image of a personal God. So how did your study of Buddhism change your understanding of God?
Well, to answer that question, I think we'd need a couple of afternoons.
Well, I just want you to do it in
sure,
a sentence.
Yeah, just what is God? If I can try to get at the heart of it, I almost want to say, Welton, that Buddhism has not changed my understanding of God. It has deepened it and clarified it. And it has helped me better grasp and make sense of or repossess some of the teachings of our Christian tradition about God being, I'm going to use a philosophical term here, thoroughly immanent. In God, as Paul says in the Acts, God is that in which we live and move and have our being. Mm-hmm. Now, have our being in God. What does that mean? This is where Buddhism, with its stress, that the ultimate, whatever you might want to call ultimate, is going to have to be found in the moment right here, in who we are, what we are experiencing. More particularly, we experience God as the reality of, Buddhists say, interconnectedness. Christians would say love. In fact, that's one of the two definitions of God that we have in the New Testament, namely, in John, God is love.
It seems a little ironic, but if I understand, and I don't want to be overly simplistic, but if I understand what you say in the book, it's almost like Buddhism helped you begin to appreciate some of the Christian symbols, some of the essence of Christianity. And I wonder what that says. I mean, you must give fundamentalists a fit. what is the relevance of that? Because I understand what you're saying, but a fundamentalist would say that, well, that could never happen.
Well, I mean, in my conversations with fundamentalists and evangelical Christians, and by the way, such conversations have been increasing over the past year and a half in terms of inter-Christian dialogue, my attempt is always to show that what I have discovered through Buddhism is faithful to, not just connected with, but faithful to and consistent with what is taught in the Bible or what has been taught in some of our traditional doctrines. So I'm trying to – now, they may not agree with my interpretation, mm-hmm. but I want to show them that, listen, when I call myself a Buddhist Christian – The emphasis, the noun is Christian. I'm primarily a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I would like to make the case. I may not make it well. You may not agree with it. But I'm claiming that what I have discovered through Buddhism is an acceptable and, for me, a deeper understanding of Christianity.
In the introduction to the book, you asked the question, and you've already alluded to it, am I a Buddhist Christian or am I a Christian Buddhist? I want you to say again what the answer to that question is, and then tell me why it's important that you identify yourself.
Yeah. Well, my question for myself was, am I really reading so much of Buddhism into Christianity that it's more Buddhism than Christianity? Is that authentic? So I wanted to spell it out in a book. You know, scholars do those kind of things. But most importantly for me, as a Christian, and I happen to be a Roman Catholic Christian, and we put a lot of stress on consensus within the community, but I wanted to write it and then to present it to my fellow Christians and to say, tell me, does this help you understand yourself? Is this something? Can you still break bread with me on Sunday mornings when you know the way I understand Jesus or Buddha? And that's what I'm hoping to receive. Now, naturally, I'm not going to go out and count heads and all that and take a vote. But if the overwhelming response, both from my friends as well as from my theological colleagues and peers, is to say, you are off the wall. If that it is, well, then I guess I would, to be honest with myself, I would become a Buddhist mm-hmm. with a lot of Christian influence and leftovers. Yeah. But I don't want to do that.
Right.
I mean, Jesus Christ and the gospel, I think, are integral to my life.
That is a very truthful and vulnerable answer.
And vulnerable, yes, I know.
Paul Nitter is a professor of theology, world religions, and culture at Union Theological Seminary. His new book is called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. Terrific conversation. Paul, thanks so much for being on State of Belief.
You are most welcome. Thoroughly enjoyable.
You're listening to State of Belief. And up next, a member of the Baha'i community joins me to discuss the fate of 7 religious prisoners in Iran. It's an interesting story. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Again, I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. Members of the Baha'i Faith celebrated a major holiday earlier this week. October 20th marks the birth of the Bab, the prophet, herald of the Baha'i Faith. And Baha'is around the world gathered to pray together, to read devotional scriptures, and perform music. This year's celebration, though, coincided with some tragic news. The trial of 7 Baha'is imprisoned in Iran has once again been postponed. The 7 men and women have been charged with, these words, espionage for Israel, insulting religious sanctities and propaganda against the Islamic Republic, and spreading corruption on earth. They've been in prison for the past 17 months, awaiting a trial that was supposed to take place on October 17th and is now delayed indefinitely. To talk about this matter, I'm joined now by Randolph Dobbs from the Los Angeles Baha'i Center. Randolph, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
What can you tell us about these 7 people who are in prison in Iran?
Well, they've been in prison now since spring of last year, so that's coming up to about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, charges weren't brought to them. Their family really had no idea where they were because they were rounded up in the middle of the night. And they were put in prison without charges, and unfortunately they have not gone to trial. And you have already mentioned these kind of trumped-up charges mm-hmm. of spies for the state of Israel and spreading corruption on earth and so forth. And they have not had access to their lawyers, although they did meet with one of their lawyers just recently, but this is after close to a year and a half. So it's really something of a charade that the Iranian government is playing with the Baha'is of their country.
Is there a long history of persecution of Baha'is in Iran?
There is. You know, the Baha'i faith started in mid-19th century Persia, which is present-day Iran. And ever since its inception, the Baha'is have suffered persecution by the Muslim authorities. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the persecution has intensified within this generation, and over 200 Baha'is have been killed, and hundreds, thousands even put into prison and jailed. often for either no charges or trumped-up charges. And, of course, no Baha'i youth can attend an institution of higher learning in their own country. Baha'is are not allowed to hold government jobs. They can't have government pensions. There's a whole array of second-class citizenship put onto the Baha'is solely for their religious belief.
Do you have any insight into what happens next for these seven?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Of course, it's very difficult to read what the Iranian government has in mind. They could indefinitely postpone this trial, and in the meantime, of course, the people are still in prison, and or they might turn them loose because there is some question of whether or not they have had legal access to their lawyers and whether or not their lawyers have had legal access to the file. So, you know, I don't know if something good will come of that and they will be turned loose or set free, or whether they will just continue to kind of rot away in prison.
Yeah. I'm curious, how in the world, if it were to go to trial, how do you defend against those kinds of charges?
Well, of course. I mean, spreading corruption on earth, what does that really mean? And insulting the sanctities of the country, that doesn't make any sense. In fact, this whole thing really is so puzzling because the Baha'is, by religious principle, have to be obedient to the government in whatever country they live in, wherever it is in the world. So they are the most loyal of citizens, and why they are being targeted, it just doesn't make sense, unless they're looking for some sort of scapegoat, you know, as maybe other religious minorities have been scapegoated in the past. Perhaps that's what the Iranian government is doing with the Baha'is, simply scapegoating them.
Well, the Baha'i faith is a monotheistic faith founded by Baha'u'llah in the 19th century Persia, as you've said. As I understand, there are about 6 million Baha'is around the world. We probably have some listeners not familiar with the Baha'i faith. So without the full course, give us the bottom line of some characterizations of this faith.
Well, the Baha'i faith is a universal faith in the sense that we believe that there's only one God and that all of the world's faiths are a part of this extended religious family. It's a family of faith. They all come from the same source. All faiths teach essentially the same spiritual message. The social teachings do vary from time to time, and Baha'is believe in a progressive revelation where civilization is advanced with each successive manifestation or prophet of God or messenger of God. They reinforce the same spiritual teachings, such as, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that golden rule that we find in the Bible. And they bring new social laws, laws of diet or marriage laws, burial laws, those kinds of social teachings. They vary from faith group to faith group, but the important things, the spiritual teachings, those are always the same, and that's what Baha'is believe.
Well, I thank you for sharing that with our listeners. My guest is Randolph Dobbs from the Los Angeles Baha'i Center. Thanks so much, Randolph, for being with us on State of Belief today.
Thank you very much.
Go to our website for more information on the Baha'i faith and for an understanding of Senate Resolution 71, which has to do with the persecution of Baha'is in Iran. You know, I couldn't help but think as that interview came to an end, what a great reminder of our constitutional provision of religious liberty, which we dare not take for granted. Well, friends, that's our show for this week. You want to get in touch? I hope so. Write to us. Go to stateofbelief.com and click on the Contact Us page, or you can call us at 202-238-4800.
202-238-3291. I repeat, 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking about the show or anything else that's on your mind. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. If you want to get involved in the cause of religious liberty, here's the way to do it. Join us. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here on State of Belief next week. More stories from the intersection of religion and politics, and probably again some surprises. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.